Good morning. I'm Cal Winslow, your host, and this morning, welcome back to our new series, Where Are We Now? Our purpose is to examine some of our most urgent concerns: climate change, international conflict, gender, race, and inequality, and the state of the Earth's resources, and especially now as we enter this period of transition. Our guest this morning is Steve Early. Steve Early is a veteran labor organizer, a prolific writer, and an activist. I think there are few in the labor movement whose writing is more consulted than Steve's. His books include Embedded in Organized Labor, The Civil War in U.S. Labor, and Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. And he's written hundreds of articles on just about every topic one can think of, certainly topics in the labor movement. And on top of all that, Steve is one of the leaders of the Bernie Sanders movement, and he was a national coordinator of Labor for Bernie, the movement that sought to get organized workers into the campaign, organized workers and their trade unions. Today he lives in Richmond, where his considerable energy and talent has been thrown into the struggle to free Richmond from the domination of Chevron and to reconstruct that community in the interests of its residents. His contribution includes his latest book, which we'll talk about, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. Steve is a frequent visitor to our county, both for business and for pleasure. And on the 24th of February, he'll be talking about Refinery Town at Gallery Books in Mendocino. More on that labor. First, however, Steve, what about the labor movement? Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Cal. Thanks for having me back on the show.
My pleasure.
Well, since many of your listeners in Mendo were supporters of Bernie Sanders, let's start with Bernie's campaign. In the 40 or more years that I've been involved in the labor movement, I've never seen such rank-and-file enthusiasm from a broad range of trade union activists for anybody running for president. Bernie is somebody that I've known for many, many years because I was a New England-based representative of the Communication Workers of America. So I had the opportunity to work with him on strikes and organizing campaigns and difficult bargaining situations and some of his own political campaigns in Vermont. He was a stalwart defender of working class people there, including members of the communication workers and other unions. So when he decided 2 years ago to run for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination, I was, as you mentioned, a part of a group of volunteers who created a national network called Labor for Bernie. And that was launched in the summer of 2015 and quickly attracted thousands of individual supporters and later about 100 local union endorsers all across the country, union members from both the private and the public sector, craft unions and industrial unions, who responded overwhelmingly to Bernie's message about economic inequality, his opposition to job-killing free trade agreements, his support for environmental protection, his backing of stronger workplace protection for workers, the right to organize, the right to bargain. And as a result of this upsurge of rank-and-file support, we ended up having six national unions back Bernie's campaign. Two of them have members in Mendocino County, the California Nurses Association and the National Union of Healthcare Workers. And as a follow-up to Bernie's campaign, some of those same unions are now meeting and strategizing and making plans to try to link up with the mass movements that have developed in opposition to the Trump administration. Many people, of course, who were involved in Bernie's campaign based in the labor movement were extremely disappointed with the general election candidate, Hillary Clinton. She's not been a friend of labor, and she was quite disappointing as a candidate. So People are rallying around Bernie once again as one of the leading figures in the movement to oppose Trump and his agenda.
So from your experience then and the experience with the Sanders campaign, it seems to me, I guess that you don't see, especially I suppose white workers, and I suppose it's white male workers as a category who simply have to be written off or given over to Trump.
No, I think if Bernie had been on the general election ballot last fall, he would have gotten votes from white working class people in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Michigan and Illinois and other Midwestern states where Clinton did poorly and Trump, unfortunately, did well. And the results in some of those states contributed to his Electoral College victory. He, of course, did not win the popular vote or even come close, but I think the outcome certainly would have been different in the Rust Belt if a true champion of working class interests, as opposed to a posturer like Trump, had been a general election ballot choice.
But there are problems facing ordinary people, working class people, including these people that are being called the new populists. What kind of problems would you single out?
Well, Bernie did well in the primaries in some of the states that Trump won in the general election because I think he spoke more directly to people's dismay about the loss of good paying union jobs in the industrial Midwest. And he has long been identified with the fight against free trade agreements, the North American Free Trade Agreement, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, the agreement that created the World Trade Organization. So he had a long track record of speaking up for labor, the environment, for consumer interests where trade was concerned. In the general election, people really didn't see that kind of history in Hillary Clinton and went with Trump, unfortunately, though that is not going to prove to be in their best interest in the short or long term in many states where people are still suffering from the loss of manufacturing jobs and the lack of any jobs program to help deal with the high level of unemployment in former coal mining areas in West Virginia and former industrial centers like Cleveland and Youngstown, Ohio, and Detroit, Michigan.
But the truth is the labor movement is not real strong today. People say it's at a low point. How would you account for that? How would you assess both the position of labor today and its potentials?
Well, one of the problems right now, and I think it's illustrated by local manifestations of these tensions and divisions that I describe in this new book, Refinery Town, about Richmond. One of the problems today is that you have a split between private and public sector unions, and within the private sector, split between construction unions and industrial unions over how to deal with the Trump administration. You have unions like the service employees or my union, the communication workers or the steel workers who are much more involved in these mass protests against Trump administration initiatives, particularly those threatening undocumented workers. On the other hand, you have public safety unions that are rallying around Trump's threatened crackdown on undocumented workers, roundup of and deportation of people who've entered the country without proper papers. You also had the spectacle 2 weeks ago of leaders of several very important building trades unions, the carpenters, the laborers, and the head of the Building Trades Association meeting with Trump in the White House and applauding his announcement that he's going to try to resume construction on the Keystone and Dakota Access pipelines, that he's going to build more prisons, that he's going to build a border wall, that he's going to invest billions in highway construction as opposed to mass transit. And these more conservative, more traditional labor leaders were there because they believe that these Trump administration programs, if they materialize, will provide jobs for their members. At the same time, Trump is planning to staff his U.S. Department of Labor with top officials who are going to be very hostile to the interests of the broader working class, who do not support a stronger and higher minimum wage, do not support strong enforcement of the Occupational Safety and Health Act, do not support strong labor standards in general, including rules and regulations at the federal level that help maintain wages for members of construction unions. So there's a lot of contradictions in play at the moment between the opportunistic embrace of the Trump administration by labor's conservative wing, how Trump administration policies are actually going to impact union members of all types. And our hope is that the more progressive wing of labor will continue to take steps in the spirit of the Bernie campaign to align with the women's movement, the environmental movement, immigrant rights advocates, and everybody else who's up in arms about the general direction of the Trump administration.
And again, just as some background, this man, Andrew Puzder, who's the CEO of Hardee's and Carl's, what's the importance of the Department of Labor? Could you give us a little background on that? What does it do, or what should it do?
Well, the U.S. Department of Labor has responsibility for enforcing the Occupational Safety and Health Act, which in many states that don't do workplace safety inspections themselves, like California, is a federal responsibility. The Occupational Safety and Health Act is tends to be enforced more aggressively and effectively under Democratic presidents. Clearly, Mr. Puzder is the fast food chain magnate that he is, has been very critical of health and safety enforcement, minimum wage enforcement, even enforcement of a California state law that guarantees workers minimum break time during their workday. His fast food chains, in fact, have been violators of these protective labor laws at both the state and the federal level. Also very worrisome is the fact that the U.S. Department of Labor is involved in supervising and enforcing regulations designed to protect people who are covered by pension plans. His track record in this area as a lawyer is also not good. He's certainly not an advocate of workers' rights, and the deputy that the Trump administration has nominated to be his top underling comes from the non-union Building Contractors Association that has long been an enemy of unionized building trades work on state and federal projects and construction of any kind. So when you staff the higher echelons of a department that's supposed to be on the side of labor and working people with people from corporate backgrounds who are hostile to collective bargaining, hostile to unionization, hostile to workers' rights, you're going to get some pretty bad results pretty quick.
Steve, I need to pause here for a minute. This is KZYX Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Our program this morning is Where Are We Now? And our guest is Steve Early, the author of the new book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Rebanking of an American City. Steve, it seems the Republicans in Congress now have unions, among others, in their crosshairs. And for unions, part of it, well, it's lots of things, the right to organize, the right to strike, the right to build independent organizations, almost everything, it seems. And above all, the campaign for new right-to-work movements. I wondered if you could, we don't have a right-to-work law here in California, but I think many states, what, 28 or something, do now. What is this right-to-work law all about?
Well, it's a labeling that has long been very misleading. A right-to-work legislation that's being pushed by conservative Republicans certainly doesn't guarantee anybody a job or the right to work. What Republicans are trying to do in Congress nationally and in the private or public sector in as many states as possible is prevent unions from negotiating agreements with employers that obligate every worker they represent to pay an amount of money, either in the form of dues or what is sometimes called fair share fees or agency fees, for the services and benefits that they get as union-represented workers. And these contract clauses, union security clauses, don't require people to join a union. If they have some religious or political objection, they can opt out of membership. But they can't be freeloaders. They have to be contributors to the cost of negotiating union contracts, enforcing the contract, and representing individual workers, all of which takes money. It's an activity that I was involved in for 30 years. And if you're going to negotiate better wages and better health coverage and some kind of decent retirement plan, and if you're going to have a grievance procedure that enables workers who feel that they've been unfairly treated by their employer to file a grievance and get a fair hearing, all of that takes representation, and it comes out of a union budget that's funded either by dues or other financial contributions by non-members who are represented by the union. What the Republicans want to do is basically make union membership completely voluntary. And that is a system that exists in many countries, France, for example. But they would continue to obligate unions to represent both members and non-members. So people could opt out of paying dues or equivalent amount in the form of fair share fees, but continue to demand services from the union, and including individual representation, and get the benefits of collective bargaining, union contract improvements. So that's the fundamental unfairness of what is legislation creating what is called an open shop. It's not the issue that people should have the right to join or not join. There's whole labor relations systems built around on that basis. But as long as unions in this country have what are called exclusive bargaining rights, and have to represent everybody in a particular workplace, whether or not they join, they should have the ability to collect dues or agency fees from everybody who's getting the benefit of that representation. So when these state laws have been changed, it greatly weakens unions, makes them less effective in bargaining. Members tend to drop out in frustration or dissatisfaction. It makes it much more challenging for unions to function effectively on behalf of the people they represent and on behalf of unorganized people when they're speaking out and lobbying and doing legislative political work that benefits not just union members, but every worker.
Okay. And right now it doesn't look like a right-to-work movement would do too well in California, but we have had the issue for the teachers and for the public employees. Could you mention a bit about that and if that's something that's going to be ongoing?
Yes. I mean, there's very definitely a threat to teacher unions and their ability to collect dues or agency fees from the people they represent. There have been a number of challenges to teacher contracts. Another one is headed to the Supreme Court now, and it could result in people being allowed to withhold financial support for teachers unions in California and other states, public employees who are still getting the benefit of bargaining and individual representation and legislative and political work, which is very important for any public employee since state legislatures make educational policy at the state level, and teachers unions are a major voice for both students and teachers and communities that want to have strong and effective and well-funded public schools. I mean, the irony of the conservative position on voluntary union membership is that they believe unions are businesses, but they would object vociferously to any law that was passed that required Gold's Gym, for example, which I've been a customer of in the past, to let me continue to use their Nautilus equipment and their weight room and their bicycles, even though I stopped paying dues to Gold's Gym because I was dissatisfied with some aspect of the services provided by Gold's Gym. I mean, the Republicans would never think of requiring any other kind of business, if that's how you want to think of unions, to allow people to continue to get the benefit as customers of membership without paying anything for it. So that's the fundamental unfairness of the open shop movement that could soon affect teachers, even in California, and has already adversely affected workers in both the private and public sector in more than half of our 50 states.
In California, we still have pretty strong unions. We have somewhat more than 6 million members of unions in the state. We're not Mississippi, but we have a poverty in the state. We have a healthcare crisis. I'm wondering if the unions might be, let's put it this way, more proactive and less defensive in dealing with the new administration. I know, for example, that the nurses who you've mentioned and the National Union of Healthcare Workers, the CNA and the NUHW, have both come out in favor of sort of a national health program or a Medicare for all program for California. What do you think about the idea of unions being involved in that?
I think it's very necessary. I think if the Republicans in Washington proceed to dismantle the Affordable Care Act, there will definitely be a crisis for those states who have been able to expand coverage to uninsured workers, either through a beefed up and better financed Medicaid program or their local private insurance exchanges that they were required to set up under the ACA. I think the best example recently of a union being proactive around community health in a different sense was the strike and contract campaign 2 years ago by the United Steelworkers at a number of California refineries, including the one that I write about in Refinery Town, the Richmond Chevron Refinery. The Steelworkers Union represents refinery operators at ExxonMobil, at Chevron, at Tesoro, at oil refineries all up and down California. And 2 years ago, those workplaces and those refinery towns were the scene of the first major oil workers' strike and contract campaign in 30 years. It involved about 30,000 workers nationally. About 7,000 were on strike, including a large group in Contra Costa County in Martinez who worked for Tesoro. And one of the interesting things about those strikes, that strike and that contract campaign, was that the oil workers' demands didn't just relate to improved benefits and pay for themselves, improved workplace safety, which is extremely important in a very hazardous industry like oil refining. But the demands they were making also would require the company to operate more safely for refinery neighbors, to increase community health. And the steelworkers' struggle 2 years ago attracted an enormous amount of support from environmental groups, from environmental justice groups in places like Richmond, at the picket lines and rallies and protests in support of that struggle. You saw members of Greenpeace and the Sierra Club and 350.org, Communities for Better Environment, all Sunflower Alliance, all kinds of groups that are very much engaged in the struggle to curb global warming and are looking for ways to find common ground with workers who, for the time being, are dependent on jobs refining, transporting, extracting, or using fossil fuel. So I think that the steelworkers is definitely a union that understands that it is stronger dealing with powerful corporations in an industry like big oil when it has community allies, when it's not standing alone, when it's not isolated, and when it's not pursuing a very narrow bargaining agenda. When it makes gains in terms of workplace safety, the communities around refineries become safer as well.
Okay, and a last question on this topic, Steve. Immigrants and unions, the threats that immigrants face today from the new administration. What about the unions? Can the unions help? Can they be involved? What's their stake in this crisis?
Well, the unions that have the highest percentage of immigrant members in the service sector and the hospitality industry, and even some construction unions, have certainly been among the most vocal in opposing the Trump administration's proposed crackdown and deportation of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. One very important line of first line of defense has been the sanctuary cities. Richmond, 10 years ago, became one of the first sanctuary cities in the country. It has recently reiterated that stance. Both the current mayor and the police chief have publicly stated that local police here will not cooperate in any way with the Trump administration crackdown and roundup on Richmond's undocumented population. And I think in cities like that, San Francisco, Berkeley, Los Angeles, even Chicago, where unions have a lot of clout, and in some places where they've even had conflicts with City Hall over other issues, they can be a very strong part of sanctuary city coalitions and provide support for those politicians willing to brave the Trump administration threat of withholding of federal funds for various programs by taking this pro-immigrant stance.
And I noticed, I don't know if you've seen this, Steve, that the hospital workers that we mentioned, the NUHW, they've passed a resolution calling for sanctuary unions and saying that they are a sanctuary union. Do you know much about that?
Well, I think it's a symbolic expression of the same stance that that the Trump administration's announced plans will, if carried out, if not blocked legally, if not blocked through mass action, will lead at some point to a resumption of ICE raids on workplaces, some of which are unionized in healthcare, in hotels, in the service sector in California. And if dues-paying union members who are undocumented are hauled away, ripped apart from their families and their coworkers, among the many other negative effects of this for the people directly involved, imprisoned and then deported, is that this will be undermining of unions with large numbers of immigrant members, both documented and undocumented. I mean, it's a direct attack on workplace solidarity. And I think unions like NUHW with this sanctuary union stance are trying to be proactive and preemptive and basically do education with their foreign-born members about the importance of sticking with and sticking up for those who are not native born.
Okay, we need to pause again for a minute. Steve, this is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Steve, let's get to your new book, your Richmond book. Most of us up here know about Richmond, but mainly as a place we drive through, and I think sometimes trying not to look too much at those huge storage tanks. Tell us a bit about Richmond from your point of view and the Richmond that you're writing about.
Well, it's a very diverse blue-collar city of 110,000 people, 80% non-white, now about 40% Latino, 30% Black, 10% Asian. For more than a century, the major employer in town has been a company that started out known as Standard Oil, and in recent decades has rebranded itself as Chevron, one of the biggest energy companies in the world. So the Richmond Chevron refinery is a major producer of diesel and jet fuel and gasoline for cars. It's also a big source of carbon emissions. It makes substantial contributions to our problem of global warming. And it has, unfortunately, a history of being a source of air pollution locally that has adversely affected low-income Black and Latino neighbors who live downwind of the refinery. So Richmond in the 1980s was the scene of one of the first environmental justice campaigns by people of color in California. A group called the West County Toxics Coalition started jousting with Chevron about its unsafe maintenance practices and periodic fires and explosions and toxic emissions. And over the last 30 years, that movement has grown into a much stronger and more varied campaign in Richmond to hold the company accountable. In the last 15 years, a group called the Richmond Progressive Alliance has run pro-environmental candidates for mayor and city council, won 10 out of 16 elections since 2004, and for an 8-year period made Richmond the largest city in the country with a Green Party mayor. So the book is really the story of how citizens concerned about misbehavior by Big Oil, the biggest employer in town, came together and organized to make their scarred industrial city safer and cleaner and greener and more equitable for all its residents.
Tell us a little bit about the Progressive Alliance then. Why that form? Well, describe maybe the form of organization that it takes and why that was chosen.
Well, the Progressive Alliance grew out of activity in several different Green Party campaigns. One, Ralph Nader's campaign for the presidency in 2000, a couple of campaigns for governor by Green Party activist Peter Cameo, and a very close race for mayor of San Francisco involving Green Party candidate Matt Gonzalez. That inspired local Greens to form a broader coalition with dissident Democrats, Latinos and African Americans, socialists of several stripes, surviving members of the old Peace and Freedom Party, and independent voters. They call themselves the Richmond Progressive Alliance, and they created an organization that's not just an electoral formation, it's a membership organization, 300 to 400 people pay dues to it, and that also organizes around community issues year-round, doesn't just pop up every 2 years at election time. So that combination of electoral activity backed up by issue organizing has proved to be very potent. And over time, as I mentioned, more progressives have been elected to the city council. And as a result of voting last fall, we now have a 5-member out of 7 progressive supermajority on the Richmond City Council, and achieved a great breakthrough last fall in the area of housing affordability. By a 2-to-1 margin, Richmond voters enacted rent control and a new requirement that landlords have just cause before they evict any tenant. So Richmond is now one of the first cities in 30 years to introduce rent control. And in a Bay Area where there's tremendous pressure rent increases, displacement of low-income tenants. This is a very important defense of diversity in our community.
And what do you see as coming up for the Richmond Progressive Alliance?
Well, rent control has to be implemented. Rent board is going to be created. The city continues to face the challenge of how to overcome the influence of big money in politics. Over the last three election cycles, between big oil, spending by Chevron, spending by big soda, spending by the real estate interests, more than $7 to $8 million has been spent by business interests trying to defeat progressive candidates and elect business-friendly ones. One thing that has helped level the playing field, that I think is a model for election reform in many other places, is local public matching funds. When our candidates are able to raise a large number of small donations in the Bernie Sanders fashion, they're able to get thousands of dollars in public matching funds. And that has definitely been an important factor in overcoming the influence of big money in local politics in Richmond.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a bit about your book. Why did you decide to write this book? And maybe you can just walk it through us to get listeners interested.
A lot of people who were inspired by Bernie's campaign have committed themselves now to run for office. This is something he appealed to them to do a year ago. More than 25,000 people responded to his website, said they wanted to run for mayor in their own town or city council or school board or board of county supervisors or even the state legislature. And so as a follow-up to Bernie's presidential campaign, a group called Our Revolution has been created, which is an emerging network of local progressive groups, including the Richmond Progressive Alliance, which is voted to affiliate. And the idea is that this would support progressive candidates, help recruit and train them, help them raise funds, help them find competent campaign managers, and help them build lasting, multi-issue, working-class-oriented political organizations, perhaps on the model of the Richmond Progressive Alliance, that would help them succeed in this goal of taking over City Hall, taking over county government, eventually increasing progressive strength at the state and federal level as well, as a bottom-up process.
And do you know of any other such efforts in California, the Bay Area, Northern California?
Nationally, Our Revolution endorsed about 100 candidates around the country, including a number in California. About 60 out of the 100 were elected. In the Bay Area, a Bernie-backed candidate got elected mayor of Berkeley. Another young African-American Bernie-inspired candidate is now the mayor of Stockton. In San Francisco, Jane Kim, who was a strong Bernie supporter, very narrowly lost a key race for the state Senate, but I'm sure we'll be back running again. She was unable to defeat a corporate Democrat who raised millions of dollars in special interest money for his campaign. In Humboldt County, there's a group of Progressive Alliance that has elected some folks locally. There's a lot of network going on in working class communities up and down the state. And very often the nucleus for these efforts are unions like the California Nurses, the National Union of Healthcare Workers, and people who are part of the Labor for Bernie network.
Okay. And last of all, let's go back to, as someone who's been in the labor movement, the working class movement, tell our listeners why you think it's important that organizations like the Richmond Progressive Alliance be based amongst ordinary people and working class people.
Well, if there's not an attempt to build cross-class coalitions of people who have a shared concern about the future of the planet and about housing affordability and opportunities for education and improved public safety in urban areas, powerful corporate interests are going to win. They're going to continue to play a divide and conquer game. They're going to, as we've seen the Trump administration already do, both in last year's election and since Trump was inaugurated, woo organized sections of the working class around a kind of narrower agenda and make it hard for us to build the kind of broad-based progressive movements that we need to defeat corporate power and make our cities and states and our country and our world better.
Okay, Steve, thanks very much. Listeners, this is Cal Winslow. The program is Where Are We Now? Our guest this morning has been the writer and activist Steve Early, who's the author of the important new book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. You can meet Steve, if you'd like to, on Friday, the 24th of February at Gallery Books at 6:30 p.m. That's Friday, the 24th at Gallery in Mendocino at 6:30, and he'll be talking about Refinery Town. And you can also look up Steve on his website, which is steveearly.org. Next time, 2 weeks from now, we'll be back with this program, and speakers to come include Susanna Hecht, Julie Guthman, Michael Watts, and Richard Walker. Thanks again, Steve. It's been a great pleasure. And listeners, please tune in.